right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Another episode of Drop in the Gloves. We got Ryan Vandenbosch. And I'll tell you what, Ryan, I played for the Hawks. And coming into that team, you always look at the former tough guys. And obviously the Hawks have a laundry list of tough guys. And the one guy who kept coming up, I thought it was going to be Grimson. I thought it was going to be Probert. I thought it was going to be all these other guys who are legendary. It was Ryan Vandenbosch, who everybody was like, that's the guy who was just a motor, wouldn't stop, just would walk through punches and never gave up. And I was like, damn, okay. We didn't play against each other, because I don't think I would have scared you whatsoever. What's it like to have that reputation? Like, I watched a bunch of your fights and the announcers are like, this guy must have cement head, walks through punches, never phase. Like, what's it like to have that reputation, Ryan?
I got thick bones in my skull. I'm a little shorter than most of the people that were fighting me. So that I broke a lot of hands on my forehead. But it was, to me, I didn't really put much pressure on myself. I was a light heavyweight, as you know, probably tipping the scales between 196 and 202-ish. I got the 212. That was my heaviest. I'm like, nah, I can't play at this weight. So I just kept it down by around 202. And the way I looked at it, Johnny, was, you know, fighting a guy like you, what are you, 6'7", 260-ish? Back in the
day? I was like 6'8", 270, yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. So Kyle Frederick was probably the biggest guy I ever fought. He was around that. He was 6'8", I think. But I just, you know, my mindset was just go in there and do your best. And if you lose, well, you're supposed to lose because I'm half your size. And if I tie, well, then it's still kind of a win to me. And if I win, well, I look like a hero. So I just did my best and I wasn't afraid to lose.
Well, it's almost a case where you were too tough because you're not a heavyweight.
No.
In the true sense of a word. No. But you would kill middleweights. So you're caught in this gray area where it's like, well, no, none of the middleweights will mess with me. And your balls are too big to say no to the heavyweights. So, like, was there a point where you just looked at it, it's like, I'm fighting Stu Grimson, I'm fighting Darcy Hordachuk, I'm fighting Jody Shelley, I'm fighting, like, all heavyweights, mm-hmm. Ryan. And you shake your head going, what am I doing?
Like I said, I didn't put much pressure on myself, but I tried to go after those middleweights, so, you know, like the Matthew Barnabys and the Tuckers of the world and all that kind of.
Well, they're too smart to fight you.
But, yeah, no, I couldn't get them to drop the gloves with me.
So you got drafted by the Rangers in 1992. Was that even expected?
I was drafted by the Maple Leafs in 92.
Oh, sorry. Excuse me. The Toronto Maple Leafs in 1992, round 8. You're coming out of where? Cornwall Royals?
Cornwall Royals. Yep. That's correct.
Of the OHL. Did you expect that whatsoever? Because back in the day, how many rounds were there in the draft? Like 50, 25?
I think there was 12 rounds.
12? Well, I'm so bad with my research.
28 teams. 30 teams I think there was back then. And then in 1992, that's when they took down the curtain, right? I don't know if you remember, but they had a cap on European players or how many you can draft. But in 1992, they took that away. So they could draft as many people as they want from all over the world. So it pushed a lot of North American players out of the draft that year. I was lucky.
And like three of the top five were Kasparaitis, Yashin, and Hamrelik. So
right away. It changed the dynamics of the whole draft that year. So a lot of my buddies, colleagues and I played with and against, a lot of them never got drafted that were rated in the fifth round. Toronto Maple Leafs came down to my house in the summertime to interview me. And they said, well, if you're around by the seventh, eighth round, we're going to pick you. And they did. So I was fortunate.
Yeah, no, that's amazing, because when I usually talk to fighters, and we talked before we came on, like, I love talking to ex-guys who played my position and did my role. They're always, and I wasn't like this, Ryan. So I'm more like you, because everyone was like, oh, no, I was a skill guy in the OHL. I led my team in scoring. I was first line. And then I kind of just fell into the fighter role, just something where I had to do it. I look at your stats. Man, you put up some decent points your last year in the OHL. I think you got, 54 points. Mm-hmm. You played that seemed to be second, third line role, and then that progressed to a fourth line role in the NHL your whole life. Right? Or was this something that you kind of rolled into it?
Yeah.
But it seems like you've just been tough as nails your whole life.
Yeah. Oh, my brother made me tough. He was 60 months older than me. So we had a lot of fisticuffs growing up. But no, my role was always a fourth line tough guy. I mean, my last year of junior, even 2 years, last 2 years of junior, I got to play a regular shift, got on the power play, did some penalty killing. So that was nice. You know, in the American Hockey League, same thing. And then NHL, I was certainly a fourth, fifth line player.
Well, yeah, which is not a bad thing. And people, well, you and me both, brother. And for those of you who don't know, a grocery stick, you just slide up another bench. Well, and you separate the forward and the defenseman.
That's right. Yeah, no, but I was happy to be there, and they, you know, they tried to work with me. They wanted to turn me into like a Kirk Maltby type player, Mike Keane. That's kind of why Toronto drafted me. They Pat Burns at the time, you know, I had interviews with him during training camp, and that's kind of how they wanted to mold me. And you know, I was told to always watch those types of players when they're on TV, how they move, how they play. Yeah. And for some reason, I was always drawn to the guys that were dropping the gloves and fighting. It just seemed easier.
Watch Kirk Mulpey. I can't stop watching Joey Kosher. I don't know what it is. So you come out of Cornwall. You go to Newmarket, then you go to Guelph. Obviously, you get traded for their playoff run. You're in the pro ranks, and I try to tell people when I do events, when I meet people along the way, they're like, "Gosh, you played in the NHL? That's insane! All the tough guys there." And I go, the tough guys were in the AHL. Ugh. Like, that's where things were absolutely just insane. And there's no rules, anything goes. And I look at your AHL stats. It's impressive. Like, it's very, very impressive. You only played, what, 3 years in the AHL?
No, initially, I played longer.
You know, you bounce back and forth. Three solid years in the A right away, mm-hmm. with St. John's, Springfield, and Binghamton. Yeah. You're getting 240 penalty minutes, 239 penalty minutes. Like, what was that like your first few years of pro? Because, you know, the OHL was tough, but then you go to the AHL, especially in a town like St. John's. Like, that's – I played there. That's a great town to play in, but it's tough town.
Yeah. Yeah, no. yeah, in the American Hockey League, people don't realize how tough that league really is. I mean, they call it the Always Hungry League for a reason, because you're so close to the NHL, you know, as far as paychecks, you're so far away in difference. You could be making $35,000 versus $350 or $500 at the time. But you meet a lot. Like, there's a lot of guys in the American Hockey League that, you know, could definitely fight, but they just weren't the best players. So maybe that's why they never got the shot. In the American Hockey League, I was fighting on average every other game. In the NHL, it was average every third game. And Mark Crawford was my coach my first year of junior, and then also my first year of pro. So I don't know if you know his reputation, but he was a bit of a nut bar. And but he motivated me. He motivated a lot of people. He actually broke a lot of people too, with regards to, you know, the way he was right in their face. But and needless to say, he was obviously a really good coach. He went on to win Stanley Cups with Colorado. Being a tough guy in American Hockey League, if I had to play my whole career in American Hockey League, there's no way I would have lasted. My body is just couldn't, I was starting to get beat up, but, you know, when I was about 25 years of age, actually, when I was just starting to get called up to the NHL with the New York Rangers, my fourth year pro, I was when I first got my first sniff in the NHL. I played 11 games that year with the Rangers, and I was fine that year. Then the following year, I made the team from training camp. And I had issues with my right shoulder. It kept on popping out. So that whole year, and I wasn't saying nothing to anybody, right? So whenever I got in a fight, I was holding off my right hand, throwing left. So my right socket was subluxed, always popping out. And it was just, I couldn't have any strength in it afterwards. So very, very frustrating, especially when you're fighting guys much bigger than yourself. And I got sent down to Hartford then. And then from there, I went to Chicago, and right at the deadline, I was traded. And I said to myself, "Self, you got one opportunity to make this work here and give them the first impression." So the first game I played, there was no scraps. I played a decent game against Anaheim, and the second game was in Philadelphia. Dan Kordick was on the team then. And we went at it, and that was my first and only fight of that year with the Blackhawks, because my shoulder came out in the first 5 seconds, and I just had to suck it up and just battle through the fight. And then after that game, I was done for the rest of the season, and then Chicago signed me for a one-way contract, two-year deal. So I was pretty happy about that one. But then, you know, so the injuries just started compounding after that. So I didn't play every single game. I was a healthy scratch for a decent amount, which the way I looked at it is I got to recover and heal. And so that, you know, helped me with the longevity of my career. And then when I did play, I wasn't playing, you know, a regular shift. So that also helped too. So I was able to extend my career until my mid-30s.
And so you were a natural righty?
I didn't know. Junior B, that's when I kind of honed in on my skill, my fighting skills, and I was throwing rights, and then for some reason I'm a natural lefty actually, because I write with my left hand, but I'm somewhat ambidextrous. Okay. I can play tennis with both hands, ping pong with both hands.
No kidding.
But then I realized I could throw lefts quite more effectively than right. So then I started, you know, using my left for that kind of stuff.
Did you, everybody who fights in hockey hates fighting a guy who has a left hand, a strong left hand. I couldn't probably break a wet paper bag with my left hand. It was just completely useless. It's embarrassing. Like I never, ever used it. Like how much of a benefit was that? Because if I fought a guy who I fought a couple guys who were lefty, I got beat up by them. Did you just want guys to open up and go left rights? Was that your dream fight, or did you want them to switch to left?
No, I did not want them to switch to left, especially a big guy like you or Grimson, because they had the reach on me, right? So if I was open with them, I like my goal was getting tight first initially. Get good position, get my hand in a good position. Whether if I'm fighting a guy like you, I'd go for the back of your jersey, because we had a tie downs back then. Early in the career, it was not like that. It was just more of a free for all. I was getting out of my jersey. It was very effective and I did very well. And then when that tie down rule came in, it was a little different. So I had to change my style a little bit. So a guy like you, I'd be fighting. Mm-hmm. I would right away, I'd want to get a nice and tight, close, my arms in tight, and then get a hold of your jersey at the back. And while I'm doing that, I'm ripping the back of your helmet off, and then I'm all cocked and ready to go. And I just had to throw harder and faster. And, you know, I learned not to punch from way out from South Carolina. You know what I mean? You want to punch from the chin and punch through the target. And once I kind of adapted that style, it was pretty effective. And just basically getting your hands in there quicker than his. And it was a pretty, I was always told too, you can't fight like that your whole career, especially after I was drafted by Toronto. They said, you cannot fight, you will not last in the American Hockey League, you will not last in the NHL if you continue to fight that way. And for the most part, I altered it somewhat, but for the most part, I was still an open fighter.
Yeah, every fight that I watched, you were just like, let's go toe to toe. I didn't see, you sound like you're very technical, but it was just, like, let's just throw baby, throw baby, throw. It was like impressive. It's so fun to watch fights like that.
Yeah. Well, even the ones that you win, you're still getting your ass, you know, you're getting hurt. I always take a couple.
When you mentioned your shoulder popping out, what's that like? Because I've had my thumb get ripped off and the ref stopped the fight, but I can't imagine throwing a punch and then all of a sudden your shoulder just as gone.
Well, it was just weak, right? It was just balanced. Like, so against the Quirk fight there, it was out in the first literally five seconds. And it was just obviously very uncomfortable. You have no strength, so I can't manipulate him at all with my strength. And I'm just using my arm to hold myself up to kind of target where, you know, to guide my left hand where it's going, you know? So it was definitely awkward. But that whole year was, the whole year was like that. You know, I fought Louis DeBrusk in Tampa Bay at the time, and it just started popping all the time, and management, you know, noticed things weren't normal. And then they sent me down to the American Hockey League in Hartford, and then I had to do the same. Well, you know what it's like after going from the NHL down to the American Hockey League, you're getting thrown as a pack of wolves. So, but I had to do it down there too. And then I was very, very fortunate getting traded to Chicago and had that opportunity to show my stuff that one last time, because I was an unrestricted free agent that year, right?
Okay.
So they wanted to sign me up before the July 1st.
Which is always a great feeling. Your first team, the New York Rangers, you get called up to. Mm-hmm. I'd be remiss not to ask about Wayne Gretzky and Mark Messier and Brian Leetch and Adam Graves and Luke Robitaille and Kovalev. Like it was back in the day when the Rangers would go out and get every single free agent and sign them. What was it like going in? Because they had Tekken in and Courtnell. Like, your roster was incredible.
It was incredible.
What's it like going into that locker room as a 23-year-old kid?
Well, a lot of those guys are the Edmonton Oilers dynasty days, right? So I was 6 years old when Gretz broke into the league. Well, he came in the WHL, I think it was, or WHA in 78. So, yeah, that was it was like my whole life watching Wayne Gretzky, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm 23 years old and I get called up to play with the New York Rangers, and I'll never forget this. I walk into the Madison Square Garden's dressing room, and first guy that comes up to me is Gretzky, and he says, "Ryan Vandenbosch, how's Delhi doing?" So that's my hometown, right? So Delhi's a little hometown. So Gretz is from Brantford, which is only literally 35 minutes from Delhi.
Yeah.
Not even so. It was a nice warm welcome. And then my first game, I didn't play that game against the Islanders that night, but the following night was in Buffalo. So that was my first game in the NHL. And I remember
close to home.
Pre-game skate. And I don't know what hotel we were staying in, but it was near the rink. We could walk to the rink. And I walk into the breakfast area there, and there's Gretzky sitting by himself at a table for two, and he just kind of gives me one of these, right? Come on over. So I sat with him and had breakfast with Gretz the day of my first game.
And got the game first. What do you talk about?
I don't even remember. I was so
nothing?
It was just, yeah, it was. I don't even remember, to be honest with you, Johnny. It was surreal.
You want some orange juice, Mr. Gretzky?
And then I'm sitting on the bench, right? And I remember looking on the ice, and I'm thinking, look at all these people. I got Wayne Gretzky to my right, and I got Mark Messier to my left. I had to pinch myself. I was like, wow, is this for real? But, yeah, it was for real. Then you get through that, and, you know, my dad always said, they put on the skates the same way as you, so just go out there and do your thing.
Which is absolutely true, but it's hard to get over that because you don't want to mess up in front of these guys and you want to impress them. Do you have any memorable moments from that first 11 games? Because like you said, with Chicago, it's basically an audition. Mm-hmm. You come up and you have a certain amount of finite amount of time to make an impression on this team, because you and I both, I was undrafted, you were a late round draft pick. You got a small window, Ryan, to make an impression on this league, on this team. What did you feel that you had to go out and do something to kind of catch the management's eye?
100%. And that's what I had to do my whole career, because I was a small, tough guy, right? I was a light heavyweight fighting all the big heavyweights. And so I always constantly had to prove myself that I could handle myself. So yeah, I definitely had to, you know, the first game, nothing happened. It was funny because I had a little bit of a history with Matthew Barnaby in the American Hockey League. So he was with Rochester my first year pro. Mark Crawford was coaching, and he hit me into the boards, and then he looked pretty good, clean hit. And then he looked at me like he wanted a fight, and I'm like, yeah, let's go. So, so I dropped my gloves and he skates away. So I end up, and then I don't know, I think I took a double minor on that, and then I get back to the bench and Crawford just giving me an earful, you stupid idiot, make sure he drops his gloves, control your emotions, all this stuff. And I'm like, oh shit. So anyways, fast forward a few years, I'm with the Rangers now, and my first game is against Buffalo, and sure enough, I'm out there against Barnaby, and same shit, we get at it in the corners, and he wants to go, and he's looking at me, I'm like, yeah, drop your gloves, I'm ready to go, let's go, drop your gloves. But we skated.
Yeah, you go first.
I learned pretty quick. So yeah, you never want to put your team at a disadvantage, that's for sure.
What was it like? Because I'll stick with that same team, because it's, gosh, I just get so fascinated with those years back in the 90s. Because when I played, teams had one tough guy, right? That was it. Like a heavyweight, maybe a middleweight. I'm looking at this roster. It's Shane Chirla. It's Eric Karens, it's Darren Langdon, it's Jeff Bookaboom, it's Samuelson's there, you got yourself. What are the conversations? And I know you're a young kid, so you probably don't say much, but what do you say to each other going into a game? It's like, okay, I got that guy, I'm going to take care of that. Like, who did you play? Was your line, like, just insanely tough?
It was Darren Langdon on the left, my first shift, and then Messier in the middle.
Monster. No, yeah. Shut up.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
I don't know. I have no idea.
What does Messier do when he looks to the left and the right? He's like, all right, I'm just going to not pass it to either of these guys. Yeah.
You know, I learned my role pretty quick, and then you know, Chris Ferrero. Once I got a little bit more stable there, and with the Rangers, I never forget this one time we were at Madison Square Gardens, and like my role is very defined, right? I was a fourth line guy, get the red line and dump it in and go after it. But Mark Crawford, I made this one play, so I bring the puck in over the blue line and I cut towards the middle. I make a nice drop pass to my centerman Chris Ferrero. He gets a shot on net. We end up winning that game. And after the game, Colin Campbell at the time was my coach. He calls me into his room and he says, you know, Ryan, on this team, we have, you know, Rolls Royces, we have Mercedes Benz, we have Beamers, and we have pickup trucks. You're a fucking pickup truck. Get the red line, dump the puck in, and either run the guy through the board or get off the ice and change. That's what you do.
Did you not see that drop pass?
Yeah, buddy? Right?
Well, it's good to know your role though, right? Like it's nice, it's refreshing. You don't have to, because you're not expected to put up any points.
That's right.
Like, you just
for me it was easier to fight. There's a lot less pressure on me to fight than there was putting up points. So that was kind of my role.
So you go to you mentioned you get traded to the Hawks at the end of the season. You have a good debut. They re-sign you so you don't have to go to the free agent realm, which is awful. I've done it a million times. It sucks. It's so stressful.
Yeah.
I noticed you played for the Indianapolis Ice, mm-hmm. and you did it in 97, and then you did it again in 98. How did that relationship work? Because I noticed in 97 you did the AHL, you did the IHL before you went to the NHL.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? Because I thought the IHL was completely separate from the NHL Chicago, at that time.
Chicago had two farm teams then. So they had one in the International Hockey League, and then they had one in the American Hockey League with the Portland Pirates. So when I got traded to Chicago, they after I played my one or two games with Chicago, they sent me down to the IHL just to play some more games. Down there, that's where you saw the four teams that I played for, and then they called me back up for the rest of the season. How did that work? Wait a second. That was the following year I got sent.
The second season.
Yeah, the second season. So yeah, they sent me down. So what happened was, so they signed me to a nice two-year, one-way contract, and so I went to camp that year and. You know, I wasn't in the best of shape, to be honest with you. And Dirk Graham was a coach at the time, and he sent me down to the IHL. So I was sent down there until about Christmas time, and I fought. I was so upset. I did it to myself. I didn't come prepared enough, right, for training camp. And so I went down to the IHL, and I literally tried to fight every game. If I could fight two or three times a game, I was good, because I needed to get back up there. I was so close, right? And then at Christmas time, just before Christmas, a couple of weeks before Christmas, I was still in a hotel. And I was like, can I get an apartment now? This is ridiculous. I can't live in a hotel anymore. So I just moved into an apartment in Indianapolis. 2 weeks later, they were going to put you on loan to the American Hockey League.
Was
other teams in the American Hockey League. So I fought everybody in the IHL. And then I got put on loan to the American Hockey League Portland Pirates. Same thing there. I fought everybody in American Hockey League again there. And then Dirk Graham got fired right around the springtime. Then Lorne Mullican was a coach then. And then he called me up. And then I was with Chicago for the remaining of that season. And then the following, you know, then the rest is history. I spent probably the next 6 years there.
Oh, my gosh. And then I don't think people realize when you do go to a new league and you had played in the NHL, and you by then you'd only played a couple of seasons here and there.
Right.
Everybody's just salivating to get at you. 100%. It's like, okay, this guy played some games in the show.
Yeah.
I got to show that I can beat him up so I can play in the NHL. How often were you getting asked to fight? Like,
all the time. I mean, and I was actually doing a lot of the asking because I was so pissed off that I was down there again and I had to prove myself all over again. And I had to do that.
What was it like going to Chicago? Because, you know, I mentioned the Rangers, Messier and Gretzky and these guys. Chicago was up and coming, but they had Bob Probert. And as a young kid, I was from St. Catharines. You're obviously from Simcoe Delhi, you said?
Yep.
Bob Probert was the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Windsor, Ontario. What was it like meeting him? Because he was at the tail end of his career. He was, 32, 33, 34 years old. So he'd already had his Detroit Red Wings success. Was that intimidating meeting that guy? Because it was Bob Probert.
Yeah,
like that's probing.
We ended up being roommates, and
oh, no kidding.
We ended up being pretty close. It was a pallbearer at his funeral, and he was a super, super sweet guy off the ice, big teddy bear, and like most guys. And yeah, no, he was. It was funny because any young guys coming up to the NHL. So I remember Jody Shelley when he first got called up to Columbus and he started being a regular. Mm-hmm. He was always going after Proby, and I was always going after Shelley, and he wanted nothing to do with me. He would rather lose against somebody like fucking Probert than a guy like me, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I don't blame him. I would have been doing the same thing. So yeah, he really had his work cut out for him every night because everyone was going after him. Our line was, we had a pretty good line there for a couple of years there. Mark Jansons was our centerman, and then Proby on the left and me in the right. But yeah, everyone went after the big guy for sure. And for him to do what he did for as long as he did and to do it at such a high level, well, yeah, he's did well.
What was it like being, for me, getting that solid position in the lineup was just refreshing. I wasn't always looking over my back and worried about getting sent down or cut or whatever, or benched or healthy scratch. It seemed like in Chicago, I know you didn't play every game, but you played a lot. Was that just a breath of fresh air to go there and to kind of fly under the wing of a Bob Probert and go, okay, this is my spot? Because you spent what, 6 seasons in Chicago? Like, that's a good run for a tough guy.
Yeah, it was parts of 7 seasons. It was a good run. I mean, I never got comfortable because I learned my lesson of, you know, when they signed me to a 2-year one-way contract and they sent me down to the mm-hmm. minors. So yeah, you're never really comfortable. You know what it's like. You're a fourth yeah. line tough guy too. And so you got to prove yourself every practice, you know, every game. And if you lose a fight, you know, you can't wait to get back out there and do it again to redeem yourself. So I think, you know, for people like ourselves, myself, like, there's more than just dropping the gloves on the ice. You know, you got to do everything decent. You can't be a liability on the ice, of course, and mm-hmm. provide good energy in the room and all that kind of stuff and be a good teammate. So there's a lot of other things that go along with it. And we had a lot of tough guys. We had like Sean Thornton come through there, Aaron Downey, like there is just Jason Strudwick. There's a lot of Chris Simon, you know, there is just so many tough guys that come through that organization while I was there. It's crazy.
And how tough was it? Cause I was going through the rosters when I was doing a little research. It seemed like your first 5 years there, a new coach every single year until you got Brian Sutter the last few years. How tough was that? Because you try to make an impression and you get to know a coach and he's playing you. Then all of a sudden a new coach comes in. Typically the only thing they can change is the bottom two lines. The top two lines are pretty much locked in. Yeah. Was that tough to always have to make that first impression? It's like, okay, here we go again. Like I got to impress Alpo Suhonen.
Yeah. Whoever the heck that is. That is the truth. And you have to, you know, you have to improve or show yourself again, like over and over and over again. So whether it's a coach or for another team that might be looking at you. But I remember Alpo Suhonen, and he ran some really good practices, really good flow drills, and then he got gassed, and then Brian Sutter comes in, signs a 3-year contract with as a head coach, and he, you know, he said all the right things, and you know, I think I played 50 something games that year. It was decent, and then the following year I didn't play that much. I think I only played 22 games. I was injured. I had a surgery on my wrist at one point in time. But there was one point in time that during that year, Johnny, where I sat out, you know, I can understand sitting out maybe 2, 3, 4, maybe 5, 6 games in a row. And I always kept it pretty upbeat, you know, and I wasn't, you know, the guy walking around with a drip lip because I wasn't playing. I just, you know, happy to be there. But of course I wanted to play. So I got to like 10, 15 games. And I was still not playing. Florida Panthers tried to trade for me. They wouldn't trade for me. This is when we had like Louis DeBrus coming through there. He was there at the time. Sean Thornton, Aaron Downey. There was a lot of guys that came through there. And I was like, I asked to go down to Norfolk. I said, I got to play a game. So I went down to Norfolk and played a couple games there and came back up. And I was still sitting. So it was like I sat out. It was my 25th game. So now there's 5 games left.
No way.
Season. Yeah. And I was so upset. I remember talking to, I'm like, am I going to play this game? To my assistant coach, Al McAdam. And he says, I think you are. So sure as shit, pregame skate happens. No, I'm not playing. So I walk in the Brian Sutter's room and I said, I'm done with you. I quit. And I'm a fourth guy. And I would never in a million years say I'd fucking quit. There's five games left to go in the season. I walked out of the room and I went back to my apartment in Chicago. And then I got a call from Mike Smith, our GM at the time. He said, Ryan, and they weren't getting along at the time, or GM and coaches. Ryan, I understand where you're coming from, you know, but you have to go back or else you just won't get paid. I'm like, yeah, I get it. So, anyway, so I went back. I said, I'll go back, but it's just for the money. Anyways, Sutsy played me for the rest of the year. He played me the last five games. And then I thought, he says, Mike Smith says, well, he'll probably get fired. So, well, who gets fired? Mike Smith gets fired. I had one more year to my contract. So I thought I was going somewhere. And then anyways, I go back to training camp. I ended up playing like, I think, 67 games that following year. And then the last game, all of a sudden he loved me again for whatever reason, and played lots. And the last game that I played for the Blackhawks was in Dallas. I got two goals and he played me 16 minutes. He got me on the power play and everything.
Which drives you crazy, because it's like there's no rhyme or reason behind it.
I know, there was it was just strange. But
so when you're getting healthy scratch, because I've been on big stretches too, but usually when I'm getting scratched, the team's winning.
Yeah,
you know, and the team's doing well. I looked at your guys' record.
That's a whole thing.
Dude. You guys were terrible,
right?
So how frustrating is that? What does he say to you? Is there any conversation pregame skates, you know, after a practice, like, hey, Vandy, we're going to bench you. We need you to stay focused, though.
It was so frustrating, obviously enough for me to quit, right? What fourth line quits?
Yeah, right.
What fifth liner? So, yeah, no, there was words, and they weren't all very nice coming out of my mouth, because I wasn't controlling my emotions very well then. And then I came back, and then there were no words. And it was just, you know, just prove yourself again. And that's what I did. And then I got myself back in the lineup again.
What do the guys say? Because like I know Stevie Sullivan a little bit, Eric Dazzi, I've met him. They're nice guys. Do they grab you and say, hey, Ryan, like, we know what's going on, stick with it? Or were they just kind of staying away because they knew how pissed you were?
Well, you know, after 10, 50, like, guys are kind of like, hey, come on. Like, what the fuck's going
it's
on?
It's a long time.
Yeah, he was testing my my patience, I think, because I had a regular stall between Tebow and Proby. And then that last game, like my I had a – because we had so many guys coming up, right? So we didn't have enough stalls for the guys that were playing. So I had to go into a portable stall. And so when I came off that ice after that last time before I quit, when I knew I wasn't playing, I took my stick and I whacked it over that stall and I ended up breaking it. And then that's when I went into his room and it wasn't very nice. And then
the portable stall, for those of you
guys,
know,
the guys were great though.
Wooden plywood.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And the guys were great. They pretty much kept to themselves, but they knew what was going on. I'm like, oh, Bush, what the fuck's going on here? So anyways, it all worked out in the end.
Man, I've been there, and I don't think people can like, pride is a strong thing. Mm-hmm. And you want to take pride in your game and you feel like you can help the team. And day after day after day after day, they're saying, no, we don't need you. We don't need you. And I've gone through those mental gymnastics where it's so difficult to stay motivated to want to help that team. And especially when the team's losing and you're sitting in the press box and you're going like, what the hell are we doing here? And I can't imagine how hard it would be to do 25 games or whatever it was, to get up and go to the rink and say, okay, and to get energized to be like, all right, time for practice. I'm not going to play, but I'm going to work my bag off. What, mentally, how hard was that? Because you're a vet now, like, you've been in the league 6-7 years. Yeah.
No, it was not easy. And you didn't, you know, you come to a point in time where you didn't really feel part of the team, because whether you win or you lose, you win it as a team and you lose as a team, right? And I was kind of like an innocent bystander. And, you know, that many games, over 20 games in a row sitting out, it was just, especially when you got a team that wants to trade for you, they're not letting you go either. So I didn't understand the whole process. Maybe. Well, looking back, I understand it now. They're looking at other guys and giving them a shot, right, to see, you know, where they stand with me. But yeah, I ended up sticking around the next year. And like I said, Satsi played me as many games as I could play. And the only games I didn't play, I was injured. I sat out maybe 5 healthy scratches that following year.
Which is stupid. Yeah. You want to strangle them. It's like, well, what happened last year? It's like, it doesn't make sense at all. All right. So I want to talk to you about, obviously, fights. You're one of the best fighters, arguably, of all time, especially for your height and weight and how you fought. Who did you like to go with? Who did you just get excited for? Because you fought everybody, Ryan. Like, there's nobody that wasn't on your fight card. Was there some guys where you, A, a little scared, or B, like, okay, I'm excited. This guy, like, my size, I like the way he fights. It's going to be a good fight.
Like, I didn't really like fighting guys my size, to be honest with you.
Oh, really? Why?
Because, like, a guy like Dennis Bombi, for example, he's pretty much my size, maybe a little thicker than me. I fought him since I was 17 years old, and every OHL, you know, then he's in Cape Breton of the American Hockey League. I'm in St. John's. Jesus Christ, I've got to go with him again there. And then, you know, in the NHL, and then I signed with the Pittsburgh Penguins my last year in the NHL. And then who am I fighting at 9 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday? Dennis Bombi. Him and I had so many battles. It was ridiculous. Yeah, no, there are some guys that, you know, there's some bigger guys that I, you know, Jason Strudwick was, and being a teammate of mine, but I fought him a few times before he came to Chicago. And, but, you know, the Stu Grimsons of the world, like the first time I fought him, I was with the Rangers, and man, the only thing I proved in that fight was I could take a punch. And then I had a long memory on that one. So then he's with Anaheim, and I wanted to fight him again, and I did, and I returned a favor. I ended up breaking his nose, and then Dave Manson's in the dressing room afterwards, and in between the second and third period, and Dave's like, Bushy, he's gonna want to fight you again. I'm gonna highly suggest you don't.
And you did.
And I did. And he came in, the puck drops, and he didn't say a word. He just dropped his glove, and he's frothing at the mouth, and he wanted to murder me, and pretty much did in the first two punches. Broke my nose first punch, I got back up, and then we went at it pretty good, and he slipped and fell, and blood's coming out of everywhere. It looks like it was coming out of him, but it was actually coming out of my nose. But yeah, I ended up, 2 weeks after that, lined up against him again, and he looks at me and he's like, let's keep it clean today. And I said, yeah, I have no problem with that.
No kidding. Good idea. Sounds good. Thank you. Yeah.
But of all the fights that I've been in, I've been over 300 on-ice bare-knuckle professional fights. I've only had my nose broken 3 times, considering I was an open fighter. I was pretty impressive. Only getting my nose broken 3 times. Mind you, I had my orbital bone broken multiple times, my right side and my left side. But yeah.
You look great. You look like a handsome devil.
Well, now I can say so myself. Yeah, well, the body is, it's all about healing. And holy man, that's what we do now. And I'm sure your body's beat the crap out of too, and you got a lot of these aches and pains, and yeah, every day I have to be conscious of how I move my body and stretch out.
Yeah, before we get to that, because we'll touch on that definitely at the end, I want to talk about the bookends, because what I found kind of interesting with your career is you started with Gretzky and Messier, and then your last season you're lacing them up with Pittsburgh, and you get to play with Mario Lemieux and Sidney Crosby his rookie year. Did you, A, you're getting on in years, you're long in the tooth, especially for a fighter. I think you probably was 32, 33 at the time. Yeah. You must have known you were coming to an end. Did you know the hype around Sidney Crosby and Mario Lemieux? Obviously, he played that year. How cool was that, being around that energy with Crosby coming into the league?
Oh, it was pretty awesome. Yeah, when we got the lottery with him, it was like the whole, everything changed, you know? Lemieux came out of retirement. The year before that was a lockout year. So I was sent down to Wilkes-Barre. So I came to Pittsburgh. My wife is pregnant. We had our first child at that time. And after we had Rhea, then they canceled the season shortly in the new year. And then I got a call from Craig Patrick, or GM at the time, and he's like, Ryan, we want you to go down to the American Hockey League and work with the younger guys. And I was like, ooh, well, you know, you're throwing me to a pack of wolves, right? And he's like, I don't want you to go down there and fight. I just want you to go down to where were the youngest. This is when we had the Max Mandel with Marc-Andre Fleury, Whitney, Colby Armstrong, and those guys, right? And what a great dressing room it was. So the point that I'm getting at was it was such a vibrant and charismatic room. It was just a great bunch of guys. We did pretty good that year. And then the following year, we won the lottery. So Sidney Crosby's on the team now. And then Mario Lemieux decides to come out of retirement because of all this. And then we got Recchi and we got LeClaire and we got an all-star team pretty much, right?
Yeah.
So we were expected, you know, we were one of the contenders to win the cup potentially that year. But the dressing room was different, Johnny. Like when you got a, like Mario Lemieux, no disrespect, but when you got the owner of the team in the dressing room signing your checks, right, the vibe in the room is a little bit different than it was the year before.
That's how both sides of it, right?
So these young guys weren't showing. All those guys that I mentioned were up the following year with myself, and it was just a whole different room, and you're missing that camaraderie. And but to be expected, these guys were, you know, young and maybe they're afraid what to say and what not to say type thing. And, and then shortly after that, I think he ended up retiring. I don't even know if Mario will finish that whole year or not, but obviously they went on to a lot of success and won those cups afterwards. But, it was just, it was a different dressing room when you got the owner in there, even though he was the best player in the world, he's still the owner and calling the shots and signing your check. So it was just a different vibe.
Well, yeah, you can't go out and get, you know, ripped up or have a good time and then come in the next morning, you know, last night, you know, and
right,
you know, sweat it out, boys, when the owner's there.
Yeah, for sure.
No, I can't even imagine. You get nervous around the coach, let alone, Mario.
Right. Yeah, Martin, you and the owner.
Yeah, it's like, no, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be in the locker room earlier today. Like, it's, ruins the vibe. So then one thing I found interesting, the next year you go play in Helsinki, which is normal for a tough guy at the end of his career to go to Europe and show off your skills. But then you go to New Mexico as well. How, just what happened that 2006-2007 year? Were you in Helsinki, then the New Mexico Scorpions, Ryan?
Yeah. So what happened there was, like you said, I always kind of wanted to go to Europe to finish off my career.
Okay, yeah.
And I thought I had this opportunity. Doug Shedden was a coach. And so I went down there. I think I played, 15 games or so. I don't even know. And it wasn't my style of game. It was, you know, way too big of an ice for me to finish my checks.
I told you that, Ryan.
The play was gone already. So it wasn't my style of game. Right. But I got to experience it myself. So it was decent living in a hotel for 3 months, you know, drying our clothes in a sauna. There was no washer and dryer. But it was good. And then I had an opportunity to be a player assistant coach because I didn't know exactly what I want to do post-hockey. And I, the writing's on the wall. And I was just trying to transition my way out of the game. So I thought, well, let's just try this out. So I go down to Albuquerque, New Mexico. So Ray Edwards was a coach then. And I thought, you know, I wasn't going to be playing every game. I'd be more a part of the coaching staff and design drills and this and that. But I was definitely a regular player. And I played quite regularly and I was expected to fight quite regularly. And obviously the CHL, you know, there's a lot of good hockey players all over the world. And I never really realized that until you start playing in all these different leagues. And there's a lot of good hockey players there and there's a lot of tough guys too. And so at that point, Johnny, I was already beat up. I was pretty much beat up before I even got to Pittsburgh, to be honest with you. And mid-January of that year, I just said, I got to pack it and I can't, my body can't take it any longer. I played as long as I possibly could. And then I had a fusion done on my neck in 2006. So my last year with Pittsburgh and C6, C7 was fused from fighting guys your size. Actually, Mitch Fritz was one of them. And messed up my neck. So after fights, like literally sometimes I couldn't even hold my head up. My head would just drop down like that. And so anyways, had a fusion done, thought I would try it out down in the Central Hockey League, fighting still, even just getting little cross checks in front of the net. I'd get burns down my arms and numbness. So I packed it in.
Loaded up my wife and my two little.
Loaded up my wife and two little kids and my dog and my cat and a U-Haul and headed back home. And
been here ever since. Dad's done. Time to do life after hockey. And we were talking earlier before we came on, dealing with the pain, dealing with all of the fight remnants that are left over in your body, the shoulders, the necks, the knuckles, the head. What do you do now to help with the pain?
Yeah, well, now it took me a while to figure it out, Johnny. I was 35 or 34 when I retired. And then I was still pretty dependent on opioids, to be honest with you. Those drugs actually work really good. They shut off the receptors. So if your knee is sore, there's a receptor that tells your brain that, hey, deal with your knee because it's sore, you know. And but, you know, those types of pills, you don't get that message, right? So they are very effective for when you wanted to play and you wanted to hide pain, and you had good clarity on those. They were almost like Adderall at the same time. It was really strange, and I can understand why there still is a epidemic on those types of drugs. I was introduced to cannabis actually in the summer of 2009, so 2 years after I retired, and I didn't think there's any really healing molecules in cannabis. It was never part of my regime during my playing days. I mean, I did it the odd time in the summertime, but it was usually when I was drinking, and I certainly didn't do it during the season because it stayed in your system for 30 days and I didn't want teams to have any excuse to get rid of me. But the more research I did on it and more documentaries that I watched, I was like, oh my God, this plant has been used for medicine for thousands of years. And somehow in the 30s, it got prohibited. And then in the 70s, Nixon government, he made it the Schedule I drug, meaning, you know, no healing benefits at all and highly addictive. And it's the complete opposite of that. So I was very naive coming out of the NHL, living in my bubble that we lived in for so many years, and believing everything that I read or heard that the government was telling us, and to realize that this is actually real medicine, and it got me off of opioids. Cannabinoid therapy is kind of what helps me. It keeps the inflammation down, and coupled with movement, you know, like my wife and I went to Thailand just this past January and got yoga certified. So we had classes every morning from 6 a.m. to 6:30 at night, 100 hours, and then we 100 hours offline, and then on site. And I got into yoga, I think it was during the COVID. Yeah, it was 2020, COVID, and we were stuck in our houses, right? And my wife kind of got me doing this, and because I've had 12 surgeries, many broken bones, many concussions over the years. And, you know, I had some slippery slopes along the way. And this yoga has definitely helped me tremendously with regards to dealing with spinal issues that I have, scoliosis, bone spurs, and stenosis, and degenerative disc disease. So all that kind of stuff. So, you know, what we put in, and then educating yourself too on, you know, like when I was in the playing days, we were so active, you never really noticed it, but we ate a lot of packaged, you know, processed foods, things that are in packages and stuff like that. And my wife was diagnosed with cancer back in 2018 with breast cancer. And we thought we were eating pretty healthy prior to that. And then we did a deep dive into our diets and realized, you know, let food be thy medicine, let medicine be thy food type thing. So there's a lot of food that you eat that creates inflammation. So, you know, stay away from that. Just stick to whole foods for the most part. So yeah, just education really on that. And that's kind of what we do is between that and eating good and keep a positive mindset. And you have to, because there's too many of our colleagues and, you know, I lost a couple, and Proby's one of them, and a few buddies that, you know, passed away, and they say they die from cardiac arrest, but you know, what caused that cardiac arrest? Well, I know what Proby was doing. I was with him one day in Toronto when he was doing a Battle of the Blades, and I picked him up to bring him home to my place for supper one night, and he had to go meet his buddy, his doctor buddy. I gave him a bottle of pills bigger than a can of Coke, and they're all Oxycontin 80s. And, you know, and so that was January 2010, and he ended up passing away in July of 2010. So, yeah, pretty sad.
Yeah, I had the same experience with Derek Bougard. We were good buddies in Minnesota, and he had a surgery, got hooked on opioids to kind of numb the pain in his shoulder, and he just couldn't get out of that funk. So
yes,
yeah, they're real.
So that's my life journey, literally from, you know, 2010 to date. I believed in the cannabis so much. My wife was taking this Rick Simpson oil during her cancer chemo treatments, and it was night and day difference, Johnny. I mean, it was night and day difference. She had, when she was doing her chemo without the RSO, she was gray. She was, you know, not regular, not hungry, down. And the RSO oil is a high concentrate THC oil, fights cancer cells and keeps the good ones. Doesn't kill the good ones. And she was just night and day difference. She had energy. She could eat regular. And then,
that's awesome.
You know, I applied for my federal license back in 2013. 7 years later, I got my federal license to be able to work with cannabis legally, and applied for my psilocybin license as well. So I believe microdosing or macrodosing, psilocybin is the magic mushroom part, magic mushrooms, right?
Yeah.
It's a psychoactive molecule, and it's creating neurogenesis in the brain, 2 days on, 3 days off, or vice versa. And it's a game changer for a lot of people, I think.
Well, that's fantastic, Ryan. I thank you for kind of informing us a little bit. That's great for your wife and great for you guys. And I appreciate you coming on, man.
Wow.
This has been a great experience. I love talking to you. I hope all continues to go well with you, and we'll be in touch, my friend. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me, Johnny. You take care. And if you're around Southwestern Ontario, let me know.
I will. All right. Ryan Vandenbush, everybody. Have a good one. Cheers. Bye.